Welcome to the Philharmonia Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 8:27 Greenwich Mean Time. Today is December 11th. Of course, today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio for the various different asset classes. First, let's have a review of what has been happening this week. And this has been a rather big week for the dollar and indeed for the gold market. The dollar has continued its rally. It found support last week and has improved upon that this week. And this is the biggest rally for the dollar, particularly against something like the euro, since about June. So the biggest rally in about 6 months. And for gold pulled back pretty much all week, is beginning to find support in the region of this $1,100 level. But there has been a pattern with gold over the last 3 or 4 days, which has been that it is relatively firm in the morning and gives up that strength into the early afternoon and the US open. And that was reiterated again in here today, where gold started up on the day and hit a high of 1142, but went down throughout the day and tested the 1110 level in the middle of the day and is closing out in the region of 1117. So it does need to put in something of an upward dynamic to really suggest that demand is coming back in a meaningful way. And more on that in a while. This was also a relatively important week for the Japanese market. It went up and broke through the 10,000 level late last week and pulled back from that region in the middle of this week, but pushed back above it again in here today. So it was up almost 2.5%. Stock markets generally remain within this corrective phase, where the large cap markets are, by and large, they are in this ranging consolidation, which is unwinding the overbought condition and relative overextension compared to their moving averages. And we define the mean as a 200-day moving average. And they've been phenomenally steady. So we have the Dow a little bit firmer in here today and back above the are coming back towards the 10,500 point level. The CAC and the DAX in Europe are both within striking distance of their recovery highs, as is the FTSE. There are a couple of the of other European markets which are have had a little bit of a deeper pullback within this corrective phase, and some of those are Italy and Portugal and Austria. And in Asia, there is that same sort of mix, but all a broad corrective type of environment where we've seen a larger number of these markets pull back to their 200-day moving averages. So China was one of the first to do that, but has continued to trend back up towards its recovery highs. Korea this week found support. Well, it found support 3 weeks ago in the region of its 200-day moving average, and this week it broke the progression of lower rally highs over the last couple of months. So that's also showing signs that it is firming in the region of its 200-day moving average. Elsewhere in Asia, the Taiwanese market was a little bit firmer this week, as was the Thai market, and Singapore remains within a handful of points of its recovery highs. And this broad ranging consolidation that's been going on for the better part of 5 months remains very much in evidence. In Latin America, we see that Brazil remains a tower of strength and is pushing on towards the psychological 70,000 level. Chile, which has been an all-round leader over the last year, is also very close to its all-time highs, having retraced the entire decline from last year. In fact, that market had actually peaked in 2007. And there are a couple of the other smaller Latin American markets in a relatively similar situation. Another one would be Colombia. But everything that we've seen in stock markets over the last year is broadly supportive of a bull market hypothesis, and it's quite evident which of those markets are the leaders, because the leaders found support in the fourth quarter of last year, and they were already breaking upwards from their bases, when some of the lagging markets were still making new lows in February and March last year. When and I'll just getting back to the review of what's been happening this week in the commodity sector, while gold has pulled back rather violently, the other precious metals have also been a bit weaker, but not to anything near the same extent. So silver has been finding support in the region of the $17 level, and really it will remain quite consistent provided it can hold above $16. Platinum found support in the last couple of days in the region of $1,400, but the industrial metals were all pretty much up on the day today, and they haven't experienced this drawdown that we've seen in the precious metals to any extent at all, really. So we have copper, which is continuing to hold this push above the $3 level. Nickel is hovering around the lower side of its range, which is around 16,000. But zinc was firmer in here today. Lead is close to the upper side of its range, as is tin. So the industrial metals are reacting rather positively to the potential for global growth to pick up next year. The soft commodities are also reasonably firm. Now, because we've had this dollar rally this week, following on from a rally last week, we haven't seen any major moves to the upside by some of the larger commodity markets. So oil has also been under pressure this week. It's hovering around the $70 level. And again, you still have this progression of higher reaction lows in the oil market. Natural gas was a little bit weaker today, but has held above this $5 level quite well, and had a very firm day yesterday. In cocoa, it's pushing on to new recovery highs. It was a little bit weaker today, but if it encounters some resistance in this area, that's probably not too surprising. The sugar market remains in this 2 or 3 month range, perhaps even longer than that, I can't quite remember. But that is following a rather large acceleration and really does need to push up out of that range. It's probably it's a cautionary note that following a major acceleration, broadening is rarely a reliable continuation pattern. So there is the distinct difference between something like cocoa, which has been so remarkably consistent, and something like sugar, which, when you look at those long-term charts going back over 20 years, they both look reasonably bullish in over that really long-term scale. And while either one to make significant new highs would probably need some sort of crop damage, the short to medium term patterns, there's the world of difference between what you're seeing in cocoa and what you're seeing in sugar, because cocoa remains relatively consistent. It has been edging back up towards its highs, and it's got plenty of support underneath it, whereas something like sugar has rallied very impressively earlier on this year, but is now losing momentum. And while there is still potential that it can break upwards, there it really does need to start getting about it. And there is the greater potential that you're getting the thinning out of demand below and supply above the market. So there are vacuums forming on either side of that ranging or broadening pattern following this acceleration. So it could break upwards or indeed downwards. Elsewhere in the soft commodities, orange juice had a good week this week. Lumber has held the majority of the gains that it's had over the last couple of months, and that's broken a 5-year progression of lower highs. So that really is an important move. And the grains have been a little bit softer this week, but firmer into the end of the week, and we continue to see that soybeans is above $10 and corn has rallied back above $4. So even though we've had a week in which the dollar has really been quite firm, it has been primarily in the gold market where you've seen the majority of the dollar strength, and indeed in oil. Elsewhere in the commodity sector, you're not seeing this heavy reliance on the dollar's weakness to support higher moves, and that's broadly supportive of the contention that there is investment money flowing into this sector, and it is not simply a weak dollar play. Longer term, when we look at stock markets, there is the distinct impression that that we could have a bubble forming in emerging markets at some point in the next decade. And if that does occur, we certainly want to be there and attempt to get out when we begin to see these topping characteristics. And part of the reason for that is because emerging markets are the engine for global GDP growth. China is leading the way, as is India and Brazil, but the large population centers of the world are the source of the really big story that's likely to drive the bull market over the next 10 years in emerging markets, and that is the greatest urbanization in history. We have billions of people whose living standards have improved, who are entering the middle classes, and who aspire to the standard of living that we take for granted in the West. And they are working relentlessly towards that ambition. There is every likelihood that hundreds of millions of people will realize that ambition, and many more subsequently. That means that their per capita consumption of consumables will rise in tandem with the realization of those ambitions to enter the middle class. And that suggests that there will be demand not only for commodities. Of course, the commodity bull market has been characterized here at Fuller Money for the last 6 years as a story of supply inelasticity meets rising demand. Well, the rising demand side of that equation hasn't been affected one iota by the credit crisis. And the supply inelasticity has been affected by the credit crisis, in that the big bull market that we saw in some of these mining companies, particularly over the last 4 and 5 years, helped to bring on new supply. But the credit crisis has curtailed the availability of liquidity, and it has messed up the business models for a lot of these mines, because now bankers will want to take into account the volatility in metal prices before extending credit, and the cost of credit has gone up for venture capital type operations, and that is impacting potential supply. And that is also a prime concern for those who are thinking about increasing energy supply. The shale oil that we've written about this week on a number of occasions is a bit of a game changer in the energy space, because it is a large pool of natural gas in the domestic USA, which is being brought online. It's comparatively cheap to get out of the ground. There's lots of it around, and there's a good deal of it relatively close to the big consumption areas of energy in the US, and those are all net positives. So that is contributing to a bull market for some of these drillers. It's contributing to keeping demand for oil down somewhat, and because we have this glut in supply of natural gas, it is keeping natural gas prices comparatively cheap. So there is transfer of demand from the oil market and from indeed coal into natural gas. Now, sooner or later, that supply glut in natural gas will dissipate, and then you will have this competition becoming more evident between oil, natural gas, and coal. But for the moment, it's contributing to keeping energy prices comparatively low, and that's a broad positive for global stock markets. In the supply inelasticity meets rising demand, there's no money out there right now for bringing on new oil supply or for exploring. There hasn't been new money being put into drilling outside of the domestic US for the last year because some of the drillers just simply can't get funding. And that is curtailing the potential for supply. And if we do get a strong bounce back in the global economy, and nobody's expecting that, but nor can we write it off as a possibility, then we could have a very similar situation to what we had from 2005 onwards, where you had rising demand well above trend on the global economy, and a problem in the supply side of the equation, where the supply simply wasn't there. And the miners and the energy companies will not be so keen to bring massive supply online because it's in their interests to keep prices high and to trickle out that supply in order to keep the bull market going for that bit longer. Over the long term, commodities will only be one part of the equation in that great urbanization theme, because commodities are the base upon which everything else is built. But the new middle class will have a much larger demand for financial products, for insurance, for consumables such as manufactured goods, electronics, food, and that is a major theme. So the companies that in the West, whereas in Asia and in Latin America to a lesser extent, we have the urbanization theme really driving the bull market there over the long term. Well, the urbanization has already occurred in the US and in Europe and in Japan. The populations of people living in urban areas is probably as high as it's going to get, to one extent or another. And the growth rates, because of the credit crisis that we've just gone through, they're unlikely to get anywhere close to the kind of growth rates that we're experiencing now in the emerging markets. And that is in part due to the fact that it's a lot more difficult to grow a very large economy, a more developed economy at that kind of rate than it is a smaller economy. But it is also due to the fact, of course, that we have massive debt problems, and the amount of leverage that has been taken on in the last decade is really quite something to behold. And it's going to take a considerable amount of time for a number of governments to balance their books and be in a position where they'll be able to re-leverage, and that's going to take time. So the countries and the economies that have been less affected by the credit crisis have a massive competitive advantage in the next few years. And companies that have franchises, well-established franchises that they can sell into or established already in emerging markets, also will share in that competitive advantage, rather than those that are specifically focused on the domestic economies of the US and the UK, or indeed Europe and Japan. And those are the types of companies that are driving the potential for these markets to continue to rally over the long term. Now, on the other side of the equation, we have all of these governments in the Western world pumping debt out into the system at quite an incredible rate. The yields are at, or they're not at historic lows anymore. They hit historic lows a year ago, but they're certainly not attractive. And yields have been falling for the better part of 30 years. And that has been a massive bull market in government bonds, and there is no shortage of supply. The attitude in the market is that you have to have them, that government that investors need to buy these because they offer security. But when you've had a major bull market and where you have masses of new supply entering the market relatively close to the all-time highs, that can't but eventually translate into lower prices, because you simply cannot increase the supply of something without giving any additional value, without it decreasing in value over time. That would suggest that we're headed for higher government bond yields over time. There is a strong likelihood that the low that we saw in down around 2% on the US 10-year was the low for government bond yields. No one can say how long the base building formation is going to take, or the base formation development is going to take for government bond yields, but the likelihood is that the trend is upwards, that governments are going to have to start paying out a greater yield if they're going to succeed in selling the amount of debt that they need to close those budget deficits. And there is a large degree of competition because it's not just the US, it's just about every country in Europe and indeed Japan are selling government debt. And the supply of this paper is going to rise really quite incredibly over the next few years. So with that in mind, we know that there are either going to have to be higher taxes, there are going to have to be cuts in spending, there are probably going to have to be less spending on war. I think the bill so far for Iraq is so something in the order of $3 trillion, and that's not a funny number. So these are the types of things that we can anticipate happening for some of these Western countries, and that's not particularly pro-growth. If we have these higher yields creeping in, well, higher yields over time are a bit of a headwind for the stock markets. And that would suggest that there is an even greater risk that these markets are going to underperform relative to emerging markets. There's also, because of these deficits that are pretty ubiquitous across a large number of Western markets, you have this competitive devaluation of the relative currencies. Now, the dollar has had a very big move to the downside over the last 6 months, and it's certainly not in the US's interest to have a strong currency at this point. The Probably one of the only ways that it's going to be able to close its deficits is to have a weaker currency and to manufacture and export its way out of trouble. But for every cent that the dollar goes down, it means that the every other currency goes up against the US dollar, and there are lots of other countries, particularly those that are measured by the dollar index, which certainly don't welcome having a weak US dollar. Probably some of the loudest advocates of a strong dollar policy are not from the US at all. And that would suggest that the dollar probably can't go very much lower without causing some real problems for a number of the US's trading partners, particularly in Europe. And that probably indicates that we are unlikely to have a situation where interest rates are rising quickly in the Eurozone without them doing the same thing in the US, because the interest rate differential would make it that bit more difficult to be short of the respective currency. And the fact is, of course, that Germany, and by extension the Eurozone, hasn't ever raised interest rates before the USA. And part of the reason for that is because of the reliance on the Eurozone on exports, and a good part of those go to the USA. But the competitive devaluation of currencies is the central theme, and there is significant potential for the currencies of some of these emerging markets to appreciate over time, particularly against some of those quasi-reserve currencies, because they have the stronger economic position. The global imbalances that have built up over the last 30 and 40 years will have to be resolved in one way or another, and one way would be to allow some of those currencies to appreciate against the dollar and the euro, and indeed the yen. And that is probably anathema to a lot of policymakers at the moment, but it is a gradual trend and probably something that we'll see realized in the next 10 or perhaps 20 years. But that gradual appreciation of Asian and Latin American currencies against the US dollar particularly is broadly supportive of investors in those respective markets. So we have this global GDP growth being fueled by the emerging markets led by China. We have the potential for those emerging market currencies to appreciate over time. And there is the distinct possibility that this will turn into a major bull market over time, in which case there will be a flood of money moving into these emerging markets, and that those will provide the conditions for longer term investors to make some serious gains over the long term. And that is where we see the some of the best potential over the long term. And of course, there will be many occasions where we'll be provided with buying opportunities, and the current reactive or corrective phase that stock markets are going through hasn't been completed yet, but we will likely be presented with favorable buying opportunities in the not too distant future for some of these longer term investments. And it will just be a question of waiting until the conditions are right, I suspect. And with that, I think I will leave you for the evening, but wish all the best to all of you.